Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is Swords in the Plowshares, episode 3 of the 3-part public television documentary Turmoil and Triumph, The George Shultz Years. In this final episode, Shultz and Reagan meet with Gorbachev again in Iceland to determine the future of a nuclear world. In 1989, Shultz leaves the State Department and returns to the world of ideas as a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He continues his search for peace and security as a passionate advocate for nuclear disarmament. Listen now, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
America and the Soviet Union have spent 40 years locked in a Cold War. Now in the 1980s, Secretary of State George Shultz believes he sees a chance to end it.
Perhaps Shultz's genius was recognizing that the Soviet Union was ready to surrender.
He understood the great strengths of this country. He embodied them. That's what made him a great Secretary of State.
Against all odds, Shultz helps to bring Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev together in a summit meeting that will change the world. In the minds of many, it will secure George Shultz's place as one of America's greatest diplomats.
Major funding for this program was provided by the Annenberg Foundation, the Stephen Bechtel Fund, Doris and Donald Fisher, John A. Gunn and Cynthia Fry Gunn, the Charles and Ann Johnson Foundation, Peter G. Peterson, Charles Schwab, and Ambassador Thomas and Barbara Stevenson.
This Independence Day will be remembered as the 100th anniversary of the dedication of the Statue of Liberty. This night will also mark the zenith of Ronald Reagan's popularity as president. Prosperity has returned, and with the help of his Secretary of State, Reagan has opened the door to a new relationship with the Soviet Union. But the polls are deceptive. For this oldest of presidents, the seeds of his potential downfall have been planted and are starting to sprout. Secretly defying Congress, Bud McFarlane, John Poindexter, and Oliver North have been diverting profits from the sale of arms to Iran and sending them to Contra rebels in Nicaragua. Historians disagree on how much of this the president knew. George Shultz remains certain the entire scheme was kept from Reagan.
President Reagan did not know that happened. Was kept secret from him. That was a completely illegal, unconstitutional thing to do.
Others are convinced that Ronald Reagan knew everything about the plan.
There is not the slightest doubt in my mind that Ronald Reagan not only knew every detail of hostages for arms, Iran-Contra, that he was the one who personally set it in motion.
As the summer of 1986 passes, George Shultz continues to be left out of plans for the arms sales and Contra funding. But even this will not protect him from the crisis waiting to envelop the administration. On October 5, 1986, an aging American cargo plane is shot down over Nicaragua. It is loaded with weapons addressed to the Contra rebels. Acting on information he has been told is correct, George Shultz denies any involvement by the administration. Meanwhile, Oliver North, who knows the real facts, orders his assistant in the executive office building to frantically begin destroying documents in his Iran-Contra files.
I am certain that George Shultz did not know the details of Iran-Contra because George Shultz was too smart.
There is little Shultz can do about the plotting of others in the White House. and so he concentrates his energies on plans for the next summit meeting. At Geneva, the Soviets had conceded they would be willing to eliminate intermediate-range missiles in Europe and perhaps in Asia. But Shultz, like his boss, wants something bigger. He wants to get the Soviets to agree to deep cuts in the number of intercontinental ballistic missiles. Shultz has a plan. He suggests that Reagan use his Star Wars program as bait.
And I said, well, Mr. President, as far as I can see, we don't have anything we could possibly deploy in 7 years. So when you give them that, you're giving them the sleeves from your vest and make them think it's your whole overcoat.
The plan is to press this strategy at a summit meeting in Washington in the coming year. But first, there will be a pre-summit summit, a chance to work out details for the final bargaining sessions. This preliminary meeting will take place at a location not usually in the spotlight of world affairs. Slightly smaller than Ohio, Iceland was created by immense geothermal forces that still reveal their presence on this wild and rugged island. A tiny country is a stunning landscape of lava fields, geysers, and roaring waterfalls. Iceland is also an ancient democracy that can claim one of the world's highest, most sophisticated standards of living. It is to this Iceland that the leaders of the world's two superpowers come in October 1986 to seek common ground. The meeting will take place in a modest building known as Hofti House. There are no red carpets, no banquets here. Just two men and their foreign ministers meeting in this unpretentious seaside house to decide the fate of the world. The two sides enter the house and move to their places around a table in a small room. If Shultz and Reagan expected only a preparatory meeting with a casual agenda, Mikhail Gorbachev quickly surprises them.
When Reagan walked in the room, the first sign of what was going to happen was in comes Gorbachev lugging this briefcase full of papers, which he proceeds to unload onto the table.
As the meeting begins, Gorbachev proceeds to present a stunning array of arms concessions.
I propose that the entire triad of strategic nuclear weapons, sea-based, land-based missiles, and aircraft, be counterbalanced on both sides by cutting every element in half. This was a very important proposal on our part.
Gorbachev also agrees to extend the anti-ballistic missile treaty for another 10 years. But there is a catch. The U.S. will have to limit its testing of the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, to the laboratory. In spite of this restriction, it is an impressive number of Soviet concessions. Foreign Service Officer Jack Matlock was a note-taker in the meeting.
Gorbachev definitely wanted to give Reagan a proposal he considered so forthright and meeting so many of American goals that it would permit him to persuade Reagan to drop his devotion to strategic defense.
As the two sides break for lunch, the Americans are impressed.
Mr. President, have you made any real progress, sir?
We're not through.
Are you going to meet again, sir?
Yes.
Shultz is so pleased with the morning's progress, he says, they're coming our way. Disarmament expert Paul Nitze calls the Soviet proposals the best they have ever made. In the afternoon, the talks continue. Gorbachev rarely asks his foreign minister, Eduard Shevardnadze, to join the discussion. Reagan, on the other hand, frequently relies on his Secretary of State to present the Americans' bargaining position.
But Reagan and Shultz had a different kind of relationship. And Reagan knew that Shultz knew the details of these things better than he did and could explain them better.
I've always said that Secretary of State Shultz was a major figure when we began to move forward in addressing problems and began talking about the future.
The short Icelandic day comes to an end. Reagan suggests letting the diplomatic staffs take over the task of working out the wording of an agreement to be discussed the next day. Overnight, the negotiating teams work feverishly to hammer out the details of a new disarmament treaty. In the confined space of Hafti House, memos are written, calls are made to respective capitals, copies and translations made, changes approved, and revisions negotiated. But as a new day begins and the meeting resumes, one fact becomes very clear. Mikhail Gorbachev is firm. He demands no testing of SDI anywhere but in the laboratory.
And Gorbachev kept hammering on strategic defense, and he said to President Reagan, he said, "Mr. President, why do you need a defense against ballistic missiles if we're agreeing to abolish them?"
We were not requiring something outrageous. We said we don't want that research to be in space. But if the United States were allowed to do research in laboratories and we cut our weapons, why start an arms race in outer space?
In Gorbachev's mind, the equation is simple. Test SDI only in laboratories. Further negotiations can then attempt to eliminate any need for a shield in space to stop ballistic missiles.
You can conduct the laboratory research in SDI. After the 10 years, we can completely eliminate all nuclear weapons.
If we both eliminate nuclear weapons, why would there be a concern if one side wants to build defensive systems, just in case?
Mr. President, we are close to a mutually acceptable formula. Don't think we have evil designs. We don't.
Reagan may not have been sure of evil designs, but he knew his precious Star Wars initiative was a chess piece Gorbachev wanted off the table. Reagan is unwilling to limit research on a program, even though its feasibility is far from proven.
I don't know whether he ever thought it would work. I don't think anybody else thought that it would work, but I do know that he thought, and he was very quick to pick up on the fact that Gorbachev was terrified by the thought of SDI. And why was Gorbachev terrified? Not because he was that afraid of the Americans, but because he had no economy to match a buildup of a new weapon system.
The two sides are closer than they have ever been to the elimination of a whole class of nuclear missiles. As the pressure mounts in the room, Reagan finally blurts out,
"It would be fine with me if we eliminated all nuclear weapons."
Without hesitation, Gorbachev shoots back with words that will live forever in the history of summit meetings.
"We can do that. Let's eliminate them all. All nuclear weapons, bombers, everything else. We can eliminate them."
Since the end of World War II, the world has dreamed of somehow getting the awful genie of nuclear Armageddon back in the bottle. Now here in a small house on the Icelandic sea, the superpower leaders are at last speaking of ridding their relationship of nuclear weapons. What has been an impossible dream now rests on one word: laboratory.
It was a strange negotiation because nobody had expected that they would reach that point. I certainly was amazed that offer was made.
I can certainly identify with what they faced at Reykjavik when George Shultz and Ronald Reagan heard the words, "Yes, we can do this, but you're going to have to stop testing in space."
I think it was a mistake on Gorbachev's part not to discuss in a greater detail and not to explain just directly, "Ron, you've got to understand, my people see this as an offensive strategy."
Ronald Reagan is eager to say yes to the negotiated agreements.
and so was I, for that matter. And so we had all of these dramatic agreements, and the Soviets made them all conditional on confining the research on the Strategic Defense Initiative to the laboratory, which we interpreted as meaning they wanted to kill it.
As the allotted meeting time ticks off, the two leaders are aware of what is at stake. They plead with each other.
We should not stop because of one word. I'm asking you to change your mind as a favor to me, so hopefully we can go out and bring peace to the world.
I can't do it. But if we could agree to ban research in space, I'd sign in 2 minutes. It's laboratory or nothing.
Reagan scribbles a note to Shultz asking, "Am I wrong?" Shultz at last realizes Reagan is determined to keep space testing. There will be no giving up the sleeves from the vest. He whispers back, "No, you were right."
Shultz, at several points, was willing to compromise SDI in order to get other things. But once Reagan took the position that SDI was not negotiable, that it could not stay simply in the laboratory, but it had to be tested outside the laboratory, Shultz went right down the line with Reagan. Shultz knew that this was not sort of the Reagan of caricature, that Reagan had thought about these issues and that he was deeply committed to SDI. Shultz was not going to resign over an issue like that, even if some kind of agreement with the Soviet Union was as close as it was at Reykjavik.
It has all come down to one word, and Reagan, at last, will not agree to it. The president says, "Come on, George." Reagan and his Secretary of State get to their feet, and the Reykjavik summit is over. They have come so close to accomplishing a diplomatic miracle.
It was a glum mood as we left the Hefti House in Reykjavik, faces absolutely as if they had lost their closest relative. And, you know, the pictures of it show it. I mean, you only look at those pictures of the two coming out of that, and you know that it is not good news.
As Reagan reaches his car, Gorbachev asks once more.
"There is still time, Mr. President. We could go back inside to the bargaining table. I don't know what more I could have done."
"You could have said yes."
And I rode with the president in the car back to the embassy where he was staying. And somebody asked me why I looked tired and disappointed. And I said, "Because I was tired and disappointed."
Shultz's disturbing appearance at the press conference following the last meeting further convinces some that the summit has been a failure.
"So in the end, we are deeply disappointed at this outcome. But if I had thought about it a little more, I'd have taken a deep breath and said, we weren't able to make closure, but we made a huge amount of progress, which we did, gigantic."
Everybody came away with conflicting views of what had happened. But in the end, what had happened was Reagan and Gorbachev had stripped each other down to the essentials. And from then on, Reagan and Gorbachev trusted each other.
Reykjavik was something that will go down in history as a very important milestone when the two leading countries of the nuclear world began to deal with it and deal with it directly.
I think what Reykjavik proved to Gorbachev was that Reagan was not going to change his position on SDI. And I think at that point, Gorbachev had to push SDI aside in order to get what he really, really wanted and needed very badly in the Soviet Union, which was a series of arms control to reduce the Soviet budget. I'm not sure how much Reagan realized this, but I'm sure Shultz did.
For all its appearance of failure, Reykjavik has actually been a success. The leaders have made enormous progress at controlling nuclear weapons and have spoken with an openness and frankness as never before. Years later, in the 1990s, George Shultz will ask Mikhail Gorbachev exactly when he thought the Cold War ended. The Soviet leader will answer in one word: Reykjavik. The heady experience of Reykjavik comes to a sudden halt. News has surfaced that the United States has traded arms to Iran in exchange for hostages. Overnight, Reagan's approval ratings plunge from 67% to 46%. George Shultz has tried repeatedly to prevent the Reagan White House from engaging in these sales.
He also understood that this was a man with a sense of history, that these things rarely work out very well. Somebody gets angry, somebody finds out, and you're left there with egg on your face. I think that Shultz's age, the fact that he had gone through Watergate, he understood how dangerous these situations were. And you broke the law, there was a good chance you were going to get caught at it.
It was against our policy. And as it drifted into getting hostages back, I opposed it even more vigorously, because if you pay for getting hostages back, all you're doing is inviting people to take more hostages.
Did you make a mistake in sending arms to Tehran, sir?
No, and I'm not taking any more questions.
The Washington press corps smells blood and pushes Reagan for details at every opportunity. What they now demand to know is if the arms for hostages deal will continue. They also want to hear from the Secretary of State. Shultz is invited to appear on the Sunday morning news shows. He avoids the programs until he is at last given assurance from the White House that the arms sales have stopped. With this information, he agrees to appear on CBS Face the Nation. But on the morning he is to appear on the show, Shultz receives news from the president's chief of staff, Don Regan, that will place him firmly on the hot seat.
That morning, I got a call from Don Regan, and he said, signals are changed. You can't say that we've stopped our arms sales to Iran. So I'm scheduled to go on, so I go on.
The appearance goes forward with few surprises until the very end. Then CBS Leslie Stahl asks a difficult question.
Will there be any more arms shipments to Iran?
Under the circumstances of Iran's war with Iraq, its pursuit of terrorism, its association with those holding our hostages, I would certainly say, as far as I'm concerned, no.
Do you have the authority to speak for the entire administration?
No.
That was the end of the interview. And the next day I went off to make a talk somewhere in Chicago, I think, or someplace. Anyway, I left. I said, when I come back, I will no longer be Secretary of State.
The inability of Reagan's Secretary of State to speak for the government has been a public humiliation for Shultz, and his candor brings severe criticism from those backing the arms sales. Some in the Reagan White House call Shultz disloyal and urge the president to replace him. Shultz remains unalterably opposed to arms sales. He later tells a congressional committee he felt he was being loyal to the president.
And I could see people were calling for me to resign if I can't be loyal to the president. And I frankly felt that I was the one who was loyal to the president, because I was the one who was trying to get him the facts.
You know, my view is that that the role of George Shultz may well have been critical in terms of how the Reagan presidency finally turned out. Because there were many people, as we now know, who were telling the president things that simply weren't true, and the president was going to the American people and repeating that to them. And George Shultz was a bit like sort of the guy knocking at the window in the door saying, Mr. President, you know, you're being misled.
Shultz fears that much of what he and Reagan have accomplished at the summit meetings will be undone in scandal. He is frustrated at being increasingly kept out of the loop of an Iran policy over which he has had no control. Shultz again offers his resignation to Reagan. The president refuses to accept it. Shultz is frustrated, embarrassed, and even angry. With the scandal increasingly paralyzing the executive branch, he goes to Reagan and attempts to make him understand the danger his presidency is in. Shultz says, "Mr. President, you are not fully informed. You must not continue to say we made no deals for hostages. You have been deceived and lied to." Reagan responds, "You're telling me things I don't know." Shultz is shocked and says, "Mr. President, if I'm telling you something you don't know, then something is terribly wrong."
And I really laid it on. And when we got through, I said, I didn't think I'd ever talk to a president of the United States like that. But I don't think I made a dent.
But Shultz has made a dent. The following day, the president tells Attorney General Ed Meese to begin an investigation into Iran-Contra. The Attorney General's inquiry confirms to the president funds from the Iran sales have been funneled to the Contras. Reagan must finally face the fact that either he has been massively misled or that his own cover-up will no longer hold. History may never know the truth, but in March of 1987, the president goes on national television.
"A few months ago, I told the American people I did not trade arms for hostages. My heart and my best intentions still tell me that's true, but the facts and the evidence tell me it is not. There are reasons why it happened, but no excuses. It was a mistake."
By the spring of 1987, Congress opens hearings into what is now being called Iran-Contra. Oliver North tries to shift blame onto the Congress for outlawing the sale of arms to the Contra fighters in the first place.
"Plain and simple, the Congress is to blame because of the fickle, vacillating, unpredictable, on-again, off-again policy toward the Nicaraguan democratic resistance."
But even members of Reagan's own party are not buying such rationalizations.
"We already have sufficient evidence to establish that this is an inexcusable fiasco of the First Order."
Ronald Reagan at last comes to grips with the extent of the crimes committed in his name. He cuts loose those responsible for the scandal.
"Vice Admiral John Poindexter has asked to be relieved of his assignment as Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs and to return to another assignment in the Navy. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North has been relieved of his duties on the National Security Council staff."
In spite of the pain of Iran-Contra, George Shultz remains committed to Ronald Reagan's success. One editorial writer suggests the best way for Reagan to bounce back would be to finalize the arms treaty agreed to in Reykjavik. George Shultz sets out to help Reagan do just that. He is also determined to work for change in Soviet attitudes on human rights. In the spring of 1987, George Shultz travels to Moscow. His first stop is not the Kremlin, but the American Embassy. There he attends a special event, a Jewish Seder, the ancient meal at which Jews around the world celebrate Passover, their deliverance from the bonds of slavery in Egypt.
At Secretary Shultz's suggestion, we decided to invite all of the Jewish refuseniks, those who had applied to leave the country for Israel. Some of them wanted to come to the United States, but had been refused.
I shared with Ronald Reagan a deep concern about human rights. And we worked on that issue hard in the Soviet Union. And the issue of Jewish refuseniks and the unwillingness of the Soviet Union to allow them to emigrate, to go where they wanted, to worship as they wanted, was always on our minds, and we always called on them, and I went to Moscow.
Over 100 Jews who had been denied exit visas and endured the harsh stigma of wanting to leave the USSR sit with members of the American Embassy staff and recite the words of the Passover story. For George Shultz, it is a moving event.
So you go there to buck them up, and you hope you do, but it's really the other way. They buck you up. They say to you, these people are worth fighting for and working for, and they're never going to give up, so don't you give up. And it was a very dramatic evening, and I can remember it to this day.
Schultz loved it. I suspect that the Soviets, some of them were infuriated by it. They probably thought it was a deliberate embarrassment of their regime. It was not. It was a deliberate recognition of something that is very close to the American heart, but is probably quite mysterious to the leadership of the Soviet Union in that day.
The following day, Schultz meets with Foreign Minister Shevardnadze and presents him with a list of Jews who had either been refused permission to leave the country or who had been committed to asylums.
Edward Shevardnadze took that list and he said, "George, we're going to take this seriously, and if what you say is true, we'll do everything we can to correct it." Schultz stood up the other side of the table, stuck out his hand. Shevardnadze stood up, and Schultz said, "Edward, I will never ask you to do something that I don't think is in your country's interest." The two shook hands. For me, that was one of the real emotional moments.
The human rights efforts of Schultz and Reagan pay off. 6 months later, Shevardnadze will tell Schultz that Jews and other minorities are now free to leave the Soviet Union. Thousands take advantage of the diplomatic victory. The story of one of these Jewish immigrants especially touches George Schultz. He works hard to persuade the Soviets to allow Ida Nudel to achieve her dream of living in Israel. Helping her becomes one of his most satisfying accomplishments.
Having worked on Ida Nudel's case a lot, one day I'm sitting in my office in the State Department and a call comes through. I pick up the phone. Voice on the other end says, "This is Ida Nudel. I'm in Jerusalem. I'm home." And I'd say that was the moment when I feel, well, I really, something was really accomplished. Whether I had anything to do with it, I never know. But anyway, she's out.
The same candor that Schultz demonstrated in pleading for human rights touches all his meetings with Gorbachev. Not content to simply discuss final points of the Intermediate Missile Pact, Schultz proceeds to present the Soviet leader with a frank review of communism. His remarkable review, made within the halls of the Kremlin, will have lasting consequences for Gorbachev's decisions about the Soviet economy.
Early one morning, Schultz brought in some pie charts and put them in front and delivered a lecture as a business school dean to the leader of the Soviet Union.
Basically, I said to the Soviet leaders, "We're moving into a new age. It's going to affect you. It's going to affect us. It's the information age. It's changing everything. And if you continue with a society that's closed and compartmented, then you will not be able to take part effectively in the information age."
Schultz essentially redefined what human capital was in the computer age. And in a real sense, Gorbachev and Shevardnadze bought into it and began to move away from the classic Marxian view that there were the capital on the one side and then the exploited on the other side. What he was telling Gorbachev on that May morning was, if you don't do this, you're going to become a second-rate power, economically and then militarily. And Gorbachev bought into that.
No American official has ever confronted a Soviet leader with such blunt talk. Schultz has a strategy that involves more than just giving the Soviet leader economic advice. He hopes to give the house of cards that is the Soviet military a good, strong show.
I think he knew that there was no chance of ever getting rid of all the nuclear weapons. But he was willing to help Gorbachev essentially transform the Soviet Union. And one way of doing that was to change the nature of the Soviet military. And what that meant was to change the nature of the Soviet economy.
Partly due to Schultz's candor in Moscow, Gorbachev makes a major decision. He at last decides to unlink the issues of Reagan's Space Defense Initiative and arms reductions.
Gorbachev had to push SDI aside in order to get what he really, really wanted and needed very badly in the Soviet Union, which was a series of arms control to reduce the Soviet budget so he could restructure the Soviet economic system. I'm not sure how much Reagan realized this, but I'm sure Shultz did.
After intense negotiations in Geneva, George Shultz and Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze announced to the world that they have agreed to eliminate intermediate range or INF missiles.
Minister Shevardnadze and I are shaking hands. And the reason is that we've now completed agreement on all of the outstanding INF issues.
In December of 1987, George Shultz joins his president in welcoming Mikhail Gorbachev to Washington. The Soviet leader has arrived to sign an historic agreement eliminating INF missiles. This will be the first time an agreement has been concluded for the elimination of an entire class of nuclear weapons. It also prepares the way for deep cuts in ICBMs, bombers, and submarine-launched missiles. And perhaps most important, the cuts are verifiable. It is an enormous diplomatic achievement.
We will inspect the destruction of the missiles, the launchers, and certain support facilities during the 3-year period of their destruction. So we will know by personal observation that the declared weapons have been eliminated.
For the first time since the beginning of the atomic age, two opposing sides are able to enjoy the sight of missiles being dismantled and destroyed. At last, the words of the prophet Isaiah have figuratively come true, and nuclear swords are being beaten into plowshares. Many will say that Reagan's strategy of using confrontation to force the Soviets to the bargaining table has been successful. But two other men have been instrumental in this achievement. One is a Russian leader who understood that after 40 years of Cold War, Soviet society had to change. The other is an American whose determination and great diplomatic skills have helped to bring about a new relationship between old enemies.
Perhaps Shultz's genius was recognizing that the Soviet Union was ready to surrender. No one else believed that. When Gorbachev had dinner with Reagan, with Shultz, with the American team, and the evening ended up with everyone standing, Van Cliburn was playing the piano, and George Will the next day wrote a column saying that December 8th, 1987, which was the date this happened, will be remembered longer than December 7th, 1941, because December 8th, 1987 is the day we lost the Cold War. In fact, it was the day we won the Cold War.
Overall, the world has become a different place while George Shultz has been Secretary of State. In March of 1988, Daniel Ortega will sign a ceasefire with Nicaraguan Contra leaders. In Africa, Soviet-sponsored Cuban forces will at last leave Angola. And in South Africa, there is reason to hope for an end to apartheid. The crisis in Lebanon has been calmed, and the Middle East has averted another war. Relationships with America's allies have been renewed and strengthened. In the Philippines, true representative democracy is at last in place under Corazon Aquino. And for the first time in history, an American president has stood in Red Square with his arm around a Soviet leader. The day has come. After 6 years, it is time for George Shultz to say goodbye to the State Department and almost a decade of government service.
We just appreciate so much the partnership that we've had with all of you. It's been a tremendous privilege for Obie and I to be part of this family. So we thank you very much. His
countrymen. Earlier in the day, the president has given his Secretary of State the Medal of Freedom. And days before, the Senate paid him a tribute. Finally, it is time for George Shultz to look to a new future and new challenges. This new life will prove to be no less productive. Today, more than 20 years after leaving the State Department, George Shultz remains as active as ever. He lost his beloved wife, Obie, in 1995. In 1997, he married Charlotte Maillard, and together they travel the world. At a time in his life when others play golf in retirement, Shultz is tackling a full schedule, wrestling with some of the 21st century's most difficult problems.
Well, I like to play golf, and I go to spas and do Pilates and things like that. But all the things that I'm doing, active in, are things that I enjoy and I think are of some significance. I'm here in Oslo at the invitation of the government of Norway to discuss this effort I'm involved in with some others to see if we can't get ourselves to a world free of nuclear weapons. And that's a formidable undertaking.
We are very thrilled to have him. He comes with all this youthful energy on this very critical issue, saying that unless you have that vision of a world without nuclear weapons, the world is going to be less safe.
Thank you. I and many others believe that so far as the proliferation of nuclear weapons and their potential use is concerned, we are at a tipping point. The danger is all too real. The simple continuation of present practice with regard to nuclear weapons is leading in the wrong direction. We need to change the direction.
It was immediately obvious to me when I met George Shultz that it was a wonderful mind there, an inquiring mind, a mind eager for focused and discussion. And his views are so highly regarded that people care what he says. They trust him, they believe him.
Shultz has recently joined with Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of Defense William Perry, and former Senator Sam Nunn to bring the issue of nuclear disarmament front and center in world affairs.
And for me, it's a great honor to lock arms with George Shultz. Well, you know, one of the reasons that I think all of us, Kissinger, Shultz, Perry, and myself, have come together is because we know how awesome this task is and how important it is.
Another city, another meeting, this time with a special colleague.
Mr. President.
More than two decades have passed since George Shultz and Mikhail Gorbachev met to discuss the state of the world. Friendship has long ago replaced rivalry. On this day, they come together one more time to reflect on past and present and what needs to be done to rid the world of nuclear weapons.
Mr. President, since Reykjavik, the number of nuclear weapons in the world has come way down. That's because the nuclear weapons held by now Russia and the United States have come way down. But elsewhere, nuclear arms have been growing.
I think we must indeed start to think about nuclear disarmament. Of course, then the question will be, how do we achieve this? You're right, there has been a growing number of nuclear weapons, and the further spread of such weapons would be a disaster. So I hope you and I will be able to speak compellingly about nuclear weapons.
And it isn't only arms. It's the disputes that give rise to the arms. How can we somehow come to grips with the Israeli-Palestinian issue? How can we help India and Pakistan to solve their differences over the Kashmir? How can we get some reasonable situation in Afghanistan and so on around the world?
Life for George Shultz has hardly slowed. Colleges salute him with advanced degrees, and world leaders seek his opinions. 2 decades after being Secretary of State, people still want to know, what does Shultz think about a variety of topics?
There are always problems in the world. And you solve one problem and that solution produces other problems. And so it's a continuing process. And so I think you have to say to yourself how important it is for us to be able to conduct an energetic, high-powered, high-talent global diplomacy. Always, always, always. Russia's very different than it was. It'll never go back to the totalitarian days. And they are heavily dependent on selling raw materials, particularly oil. If the price goes down, they will feel that. And the other problem they have is demography. The birth rate is very low. Longevity, it's the only country of any importance where the age of death has been going down, not up, down. The situation in the Middle East is always difficult. That hasn't changed. But there's no real authority there for Israel to deal with. That's why it seems to me worthwhile to see if you can't get the Egyptians and the Jordanians to join with Palestinians, and then you have states that can speak with a little bit more authority. It's been proven that economies work best when you let the market operate and you let people have some private property, and then let the spirit of entrepreneurship go and give people access to education. When you do those things, the economy moves better than if you try to plan everything from the top. Well, there are always possibilities. And if you're the negotiator, if you're the Secretary of State, you got to be willing to go out and invest your capital in them, recognizing that even if nothing positive happens, if you prevent negative things from happening, that's something of a triumph. So you got to engage, engage, engage all the time.
Shultz's life today is filled with an active schedule of conferences and seminars, book writing and speeches. But there is always time for family. The personal highlight of George Shultz's year is still the annual summer reunion at the family farm in Massachusetts.
I've been coming here to this area all my life, since I was born. And so when I think of where I'm from, this is where I'm from, so this is home to me. And the old farmhouse is just a wonderful place to be and lots of good memories.
This nice old house I first went into in late 1945 when I came home from the Pacific as a active duty Marine during World War II. My parents had retired here. I thought it was charming right from the minute I entered it. It's the kind of place you keep some old shoes and old clothes and you come and you just relax. And so we moved around a lot as a family. This is always the place we came back to. So in many respects, this is roots. It stands for a family. And families are very important. If you're lucky enough to have one, you appreciate it.
People think of him in the public eye, but he's a wonderful family person. He's loving to his children and to his wife. And so that's a great part of him.
He's always been Dad. I mean, that's a pretty great guy, you know? He's always been a great guy. And Dad, and it was funny when people began to notice him But he didn't change any for us.
You know, if we did something that we probably weren't supposed to do, we were always given a chance to explain ourselves.
He lived his life with a great deal of integrity, and that's helped all of us.
The expectation isn't that we're going to be Secretary of State. You know, he's proud of us for what we do.
Yeah. Go out and have, live your life and be happy.
I was very proud of him. I am proud of him. He's a remarkable human being who's only become more remarkable with time.
Yeah, we all do it.
And we all learned how to do it.
An annual tradition is the cooking of the Schultz family steak.
Well, I would put the first one right there. Yeah.
Oh, gotcha.
For George's, 1 minute on each side.
I got to go check this
He's
one.
He's a rare guy, you know?
The family steak recipe has also been used for diplomatic purposes.
Well, one of the things I did when I was in office was I used it as an icebreaker. And whenever Shevardnadze was a new foreign minister of the Soviet Union, I invited him to my house in Washington. We had a fire in the fireplace, and we did this, and we both got down together on our hands and knees and messing with the steak.
You can go ahead.
And it formed a sort of a bond. And I did the same thing with Wu Qichen, who was new foreign minister in China. So between China and the Soviet Union, the steak did us a lot of good. Full hearts, our Father, for all thy blessings, and make us ever mindful of the needs of others. Through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.
The true truth contributed sanity, balance, a sense of direction, an understanding of how the political process in this country worked.
He understood the great strengths of this country. He understood the great ideals of this country. He communicated them, he embodied them. That's what made him a great Secretary of State.
Schultz was, I think, really very good in understanding his own time. He was not locked in to the Cold War of the 1950s and 60s, as many people were in the 1980s, particularly some people in the Reagan administration.
I think that Schultz will be considered by history as one of the greatest, if not the greatest, Secretary of State.
He has had a fascinating life. His inexhaustible curiosity and an endlessly inquiring mind have led to a variety of important positions. Each would have provided a demanding career for most men. From MIT to the University of Chicago, from business to cabinet positions, it is hard to see one of these as more significant than the other. But they have all had one thing in common. They have all been anchored in the world of learning and ideas. It is a world he has returned to in his final working years.
You always start with ideas. And if you don't start with ideas, you get lost. But if you start with ideas, then that's sort of a compass. That gives you a sense of strategy. It gives you a sense of where you're going.
Today, George Schultz is a senior fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. It is a perfect place to listen and give back to young minds, minds that are usually filled with questions.
And so I was wondering, in service, how you muster the capability to go against the grain and to do what is
I wondered if you might talk a little bit about a time where you had an idea that was really influenced or changed by
someone. So I guess my question is, how do we value different types of public service?
What sort of management styles have been most effective for you?
In any administration, you'll find there are people on this side and there are people on this side and there are arguments and you're on one of those sides. People often deplore that, but I think on the contrary, they should be happy about that because the issues are usually momentous. And you'd like to think that they're being argued about. That before, when you have a chance to be in a classroom or be in a room around a table talking with them, it's very stimulating. It's always impressive to me how much these kids know and how bright they are and how thoughtful they are. They're usually complimentary afterwards and thank me for coming. I say to them, thank you for having me. I learned a lot here. So you realize that there are smart people everywhere, and if you listen to them, you just might learn something.
For more than 60 years, ideas have been the guiding force in George Shultz's life. Ideas about freedom and human opportunity and a peaceful planet. They are ideas that have helped make America and the world a better place.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.